This is Fresh Air. I'm Artie Moscow-Wain. In April 1993, the United Nations commander in Bosnia, General Philippe Morillon, drove into the besieged Bosnian town of Srebrenica and promised to protect the Muslim refugees there. Under his leadership, the rebel Serbs and the Bosnian government signed an agreement that the enclave of Srebrenica would be a safe haven. For 2 years, this UN deterrence worked. But early last month, that safe haven was violated by Bosnian Serb forces who attacked Srebrenica. The UN peacekeepers in the area stood by and could do nothing. Srebrenica fell to the Serbs on July 11th. The women, children, and older Bosnians were evacuated to a refugee camp in Tuzla. The men of military age were reportedly taken away to be interrogated. My guest, Christina Smits, was in Srebrenica when it fell to the Serbs. She's a nurse with the humanitarian aid group Doctors Without Borders. Schmitz and Dr. Daniel O'Brien arrived in Srebrenica on June 24th to provide medical care and supplies. They were the only international relief workers in the enclave at that time. I asked Christina Schmitz to tell us about the beginning of the siege.
There were some kind of indicators on the 5th of July. Troops were moving around the enclave. Of course, I didn't see this myself, but the United Nations, the Blue Helmets, did inform me about it. And then on the 6th, in the early morning, the Serbs started with bombing the surrounding of Srebrenica and later on the center itself.
Can you describe for us those first couple of hours of the bombing?
Well, we were waking up in the morning at 4:30 due to the noise of the bombing. We were quite shocked. What we decided on the spot then is taking our communication material and moving into our shelter underground. Of course, we couldn't sleep anymore. We were quite frightened. But on the other side, we knew that sooner or later this would happen. So we were somehow prepared.
What was this shelter like?
It was a small shelter in an underground of the house beside the hospital. You had space for a table and some beds and some shelves. It was very small. It was very dark, wet, and cold.
How many people could fit into that shelter?
Well, in order to live some days, it was possible to accommodate approximately 5 people.
And in the shelter, you could hear the bombing around you?
Sure. We could hear them. It was the same like being in a house. But, of course, we were much better protected in case a shell would fall on the house.
When were you first able to assess the damage and assess the numbers of wounded and dead?
Already in the morning. What we did is, between the shellings, we were waiting a little while, although normally you have to wait half an hour, but then we would never have managed to go out anymore. So in between the shellings, we were taking our bulletproof vests and we were running into the hospital and see how the situation was. In the morning of this very first day, we had already at lunchtime more than 13 wounded. So the local team and Daniel, who was the Australian GP working with me, they were very busy with coping with this number of war wounded.
And what kinds of wounds then were you seeing?
Well, a lot of shrapnel wounds, but then you had also a lot of people who lost an arm or a leg, or people who had bigger pieces right in their abdomen. So it was very different, many different wounds. And most of the wounds or most of the patients were heavily wounded.
And did you have the right kinds and enough medicine to be able to treat these wounded?
Yes. Looking back, I can say that we were able to cope with all these wounded. At that moment, of course, we were very careful that we didn't use too much fluids because we didn't know how long this would take and how much people more we would receive. So it was a very difficult situation. We would have liked to treat the people, let me say, better. We would have liked to offer more infusions and so on. But this was not possible since we didn't know how long it would last.
And what did the UN peacekeepers do during the siege?
Well, during the siege, they had around the enclave approximately 8 observation points, and these observation points were, they lost them one by one in these days, so they had to withdraw.
And where did they go?
They went to Potocari. This is a base. This was their main base, 5 kilometers further away from the town of Srebrenica towards the north, and also at Yellow Bridge, which was the border of the enclave. There they had a huge compound, a huge building where they were living.
Christina Schmitz is our guest today, and she's a nurse with Doctors Without Borders, and she was in Srebrenica when the enclave fell in July. You made a note on Friday, the 7th of July, that's the day after the bombing started, and you wrote, "There are still shellings, and we can see people staying outside, letting their children play in the streets." Do you understand why people allowed their children to play in the streets?
If I am right with my assessment, then I think that the people were very fatalistic. People were thinking, nobody can protect us anyway, so why bother and seeking shelter? Also, many of the people didn't have an underground shelter, so being in the houses, they were not really protected. I think the people did care a lot about their children, but they didn't care anymore a lot about their future.
What kinds of precautions did you take when you were there to either find the wounded or take care of the wounded to move out onto the streets of Srebrenica?
Well, in the beginning, we took too many risks. We went by car to pick up the wounded because there was hardly any other transport means for them. But later on, we realized that without an APC, without an armored personnel carrier, it would not be very wise to go into the streets. Although for me it was very difficult to sit in the bunker knowing they are wounded and knowing that it will be difficult for them to get to the hospital. But I realized, of course, very much if myself I would get wounded, then the whole project would be in danger. So somehow the people managed to go to the hospital to come for assistance, and yeah, that was okay.
Were there local doctors and nurses that were still there that you could work with?
Yes, indeed. We would never have managed this by ourselves. You had a team of 5 local doctors, including a GP who had been trained by Doctors Without Borders to perform operations because there was no real surgeon in Srebrenica. And you had a lot of nursing staff. Altogether, there were 125 medical people in the hospital. So there was enough staff until the day of the 11th, when Srebrenica was falling. At that day, more than 80% of the staff fled through the forests to Tuzla. And they were very afraid that the Serbs would enter the hospital, kill all the staff and the patients. So they disappeared.
Was the hospital targeted at all or hit at all during the siege?
The hospital was targeted, yes. There was a bomb a few days before the siege of Srebrenica. One was falling right opposite of the hospital, right opposite of our house, and another one a bit further away. So speaking about Geneva Conventions or speaking about a neutral zone, what the Serbs in Pale as well promised us and assured us that the hospital would stay in neutral zone, it was ridiculous. It was just not true.
Was the hospital well marked?
Yes, indeed. Indeed, it was well marked. You had big flags of Doctors Without Borders on the walls and on the roof. I'm sure that everybody knew this is the hospital. This was very obvious.
And did the bombing do damage to the hospital at all?
It did damage the windows. So the windows in the hospital were mostly broken, but there were no big injuries with the glass splitters from the patients.
Now, on July 11th, that's when most of the people of Srebrenica and yourselves included decided to flee. Is that right?
Yes. Yes.
What was it like to, I guess, prepare yourself to flee this city?
Well, I have to admit that I was never really prepared before the falling of Srebrenica, I didn't think this would happen, and I didn't think this would happen so fast and so organized like the Serbs did it. So I had problems to believe it when I saw again the whole population fleeing to Potocari in the early afternoon. Then the NATO airstrikes took place, and then we saw the hospital was almost empty. Part of the patients were already evacuated to Potocari. So we decided, okay, we have to go as well. We packed a few things which we had in our shelter, but of course there was no time anymore to go back to the house, so we lost a lot of our private things. We took the rest of the patients with us, although I had to leave six behind because I had no space anymore in the car, and the Serbs were already proceeding, so we had to leave them behind, which I found very difficult. However, it was too dangerous to return again.
And these were people that could not have left on their own because they were so sick or they were so wounded?
No, they were old people. They were just not able to walk because they were just very old. They were not. They were internal patients. The surgical patients, again, these were most of them were young men and with war injuries. They were already evacuated to Potocari. The old internal patients we could take with us, but six of them they had to stay behind.
So what was that life like to leave them behind?
Well, for me, it was very difficult. The moment when I left them, I still was thinking I can go back. So I said, please stay where you are. I'm coming back. I had gone back already a second time. So I hoped people believed me. But then when I came out of the hospital and I saw the APCs moving already off the blue helmets, so they had already passed the hospital, which meant that the Serb army must have proceeded. So I talked very briefly to them, and then I realized it's just too dangerous to go back. I can't do anything anymore. For me, it was very difficult, very hard to accept it.
Did you get back to that hospital at all once you got to Potocari?
Yes. On the 13th, 2 days later, when the Serbs had deported already all the refugees, I tried to negotiate with them and I said, please let me go back into Srebrenica. I know there are patients left. I want to pick them up. So they agreed. They gave me an escort. Otherwise, I would never have managed to go into the town. And I went with one member of UNMO, the United Nations Military Observer. I went with him and with the Serbian escort back into town. And indeed, I found three of the old people back in the hospital. What happened with the other three, I don't know. And we did find another three in our social center, which we could pick up. So we returned with six old patients, which was, well, I was very happy about that. But it was very strange to return to Srebrenica to see the empty town, to see the place where I had been living before.
What did it look like?
It was very empty. Not many of the places were destroyed by the shelling, but the Serbs started to loot, and you had at every corner, you had the washing machines and the TVs and the furniture. The Serbs were chasing the livestock down to their first Serbian town. So it was very sad for me.
My guest is Christina Schmitz, a nurse with Doctors Without Borders. She was in Srebrenica when the city fell to the Serbs. More after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Christina Schmitz, a nurse with Doctors Without Borders. She was in Srebrenica when the enclave fell in July. Now, you moved on to Potocari after leaving Srebrenica.
Yeah.
And you said that you weren't able to leave Srebrenica with many medical supplies at all. What were you able to do as a nurse and as doctors with Doctors Without Borders to care for the refugees now in Potocari?
Well, we were bringing the patients into the UN compound, and the Blue Helmets, the Dutch Blue Helmets, started immediately to assist us with setting up a makeshift hospital in the corridor. They put up stretchers. And also we got the necessary supplies from them. So we could well take care for the patients. For the people outside, I was going with a kind of ambulance outside and picking up the ones who were either wounded or old. Then you had a lot of women especially who got hysteric due to the situation, who couldn't cope anymore, the presence of heavily armed Serbs. These ones we took as well in our care.
What did you witness in terms of the Serb treatment of the people from Srebrenica?
I have witnessed that the Serbs were treating the people like kind of animals. The people had to run to the buses. The people had to leave a lot of their things which they had managed to bring. They had to leave them behind. The Serbs were separating the men. The Dutch Blue Helmets can confirm executions of 9 men. This is what they have seen. I didn't see it, but I heard it.
Now, did you see the Bosnian Serb army separate the people from Srebrenica, the men from the women?
Yes. And there was one very impressive example which is still following me, which is still a kind of nightmare to me. I was outside in the camp trying to assess some patients. The UN doctors had made a kind of triage and had chosen already patients which need to go into the hospital. And in that moment, a crying father is coming to me with a Serb soldier behind him. And in the same moment, I know what is going to happen. The father is telling me while crying and while very disturbed that he has nobody to take care for his baby. The mother has been killed apparently during the bombardment, and his own mother is not living either anymore. So he doesn't have anybody for this child. He wants to hand it to me, and he has to go with the Serbian soldier, and it's very obvious what's going to happen. And for me, it's very clear that he will not see this child again. So we take this child in our care. We take it into the hospital. We evacuated later with the patients to Tuzla. But this has been one individual case where I have seen it, what the Serbs are doing, and which has really made it a very horrible experience for me.
Can you tell us what happened to that father?
Of course, I haven't seen what happened with the father. But I think everybody can find his own way of thinking what happened with the men. Again, the Dutch Blue Helmets could confirm executions. Again, the Serbs were even separating later on the male patients from our patients, bringing them to places which we didn't know. So it's beyond my knowledge, but it's not beyond my imagination.
And according to the reports, it was some 5,200 Muslim men and, I guess, young men, and even some question about whether boys were taken along as well.
Yes, of course. Again, I heard that there was a big number of men taken. What we did ask during the whole crisis is that we would have international monitors from, for example, the International Red Cross, because they have the prisoners of war in their mandate. So we did request this very firmly and very often, but the Serbs didn't allow anybody from any organization in until all the refugees had gone.
And what was it like, I guess, to appeal to the Bosnian Serb commanders? Would they listen to what you wanted and your concerns for the fate of these people?
In the first day on the 12th, when the Serbs came to Potočari, I went to Ratko Mladic, who is the Serbian commander, and I asked him that we, Doctors Without Borders, together with the Dutch Blue Helmets, would like to do the evacuation of the patients and not that the Serbs would take this over, what was in the beginning the plan. He hardly was listening to me. He just told me to do my job, and he went away. I could discuss easier later on with his deputies or with other important commanders who would listen to me and whom I could tell, listen, I want to go out in this camp now, I want to pick up the wounded, or I could inform them about what we had planned with the evacuation of the wounded and so on. So I was always present in the meetings with the Serbs. It was in the beginning very tense, and some personalities were very unpleasant. Maybe they didn't like it that Doctors Without Borders was there, since they were not allowing anybody in, any international organization, but of course they were not able to get us out in that moment. Later on, the discussions were more relaxed and easy, but of course very cynical. While we were discussing about art in meetings, I still had to think about the refugees being taken by the Serbs to another place. So I had problems with that personally, but for the meetings, it went all right.
Let me just make sure I understand what you said, that during these meetings there was discussion of art?
Yes, discussions like you could have here with a friend. But it happened in a surrounding where just 30,000 people were being deported, where ethnic cleansing took place, and I had to be on this level of these meetings. But I managed, because my purpose was still to assist the population, and if it had to be like this, I could cope with it.
What is it like then to try to come down, if I can use an American expression, come down from an experience like the one that you've had in Srebrenica?
For me, it's the first time. You know, I have been in many war situations. I have been in war countries in Africa. I had to work in Chechnya before. But I never had this experience like it happened in Srebrenica. I was never in situations where I was only with two people, only with two international members of an organization responsible more or less for 40,000 refugees. But what was more difficult for me is that I had to sit, or that I had to watch and to accept what the Serbs were doing. I'm still more and more actually being depressed about it. I find it very difficult. Every morning when I wake up, I am in Potocari, I'm not in Germany. I'm thinking a lot about what happened. I feel quite guilty that we could not do more about it. I feel quite guilty that we were not prepared for the fall of Srebrenica. So all in all, the experience is very difficult for me, and it will take a long time until I can be ready to go to another war situation.
Christina Schmitz is a nurse with Doctors Without Borders. She was in Srebrenica when the enclave fell in July. She has also worked in Croatia, Liberia, Kurdistan, Sudan, and Chechnya. I'm Artie Moskowain. This is Fresh Air.